Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today, Helen Roslin is talking about Britain's history told through its art collection.
I'm delighted to be back again, flying the flag for collectors, because of course collectors of whatever type really provide us with a tangible way into our history. So that's why it's very important to have them at a history festival. Now, I would just add to Peter's advice to go and have the talk tomorrow and the tour, because I went round the house with Jane, who I think is here, and she managed to answer every single question I threw at her. In fact, I'm sure she's here so she can see if I was paying attention. But I would really recommend it. But of course, when you go round a house, things are not necessarily presented in a very chronological, neat way. So I thought, You may well come away with a sense of the collection, but without a very good idea of the story of how it all came into being. So I thought that that's perhaps what I should try and do today. Try and pick out particularly parts of the collection that tell us about the people who built the collection, the Earls of Pembroke. And also just to set it against its wider context of what was going on outside the walls of Wilton at the time. So, as Peter said, I'm going to try and race through 250 years, 10 earls, so I better get going. And I've had to be very selective. There's so much more, and I can't say enough. Do go and have a look at it if you get the chance. So, here we are. This is obviously my starting point. The first man, William Herbert, who was born at the beginning of the 16th century and became first Earl of Pembroke in 1551. He was closely associated with four Tudor courts, and starting by being the gentleman of the bedchamber to Henry VIII. He then married Anne Parr. Here you see her carved into the Holbein porch at Wilton. And Anne Parr, of course, was the sister of the woman who was going to become Henry VIII's last queen. So he, in effect, became the brother-in-law of King Henry VIII. So he was obviously knighted at this point. And shortly after his marriage, he was made chief steward of Wilton Abbey. And then, of course, during the dissolution of the monasteries, the lands and buildings at Wilton were made over to him. So that's when the first Tudor house was built there. When Henry VIII died, Sir William Herbert was one of the people who was appointed to be the guardian of the young King Edward VI. And King Edward VI was the one who made him first Earl of Pembroke in 1551, coming to stay at Wilton shortly after that. Now, just to set it in context here, you must remember that in the Tudor court, nobody really was collecting paintings, because although there'd been some early signs of picture collecting under Henry VII, the Protestant Reformation had put an end to all that, because in people's minds, collecting and paintings were associated with Catholicism, so they weren't at all welcome. Instead, the walls of great houses were hung with tapestries. But in a year, 1560, where it was recorded that there were just 56 paintings in the Royal Gallery at St James's, it's also recorded that the first Earl of Pembroke had 60 paintings in his collection. So he really was one of the very early collectors in this country of paintings. Because paintings were of so little value, unfortunately, they were not really recorded in detail. So inventories don't give us any clear idea of what was in this early collection. But the existence of this particular portrait by the Flemish artist Jan Gossert in the Wilton collection is very intriguing, because there's another version of the same painting in the Royal Collection, which is thought to have been acquired by Henry VIII at the time of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, because Catherine of Aragon was the great aunt of these three children, who are the children of King Christian II of Denmark. The version in the Royal Collection is much more highly finished. It's got decorations on the children's necks and on their headdresses, and the cherries have stalks. So it's really quite possible, and almost one of the most likely routes into this collection, that the two versions came over to England together at that time, and the unfinished version was given to Sir William Herbert, because he was obviously close to the court and was interested in art collecting. So that could be one of the really early pictures in this collection. And of course, he was definitely a person of some importance, because here he is. He was painted by the court painter to Mary I, Hans Ewers. And in fact, this painting is now catalogued as School of Hans Hewers. And I just quickly say that that's very usual for paintings of this age, because painters were not considered important enough to be recorded their names. So quite often, if you go through the Tudor galleries at the National Portrait Gallery, for example, you'll see that a lot of the paintings are School of, Studio of, or Unknown Hand. But anyway, this painting here is very typical 16th century portrait, because the story really is still being told through the detail, the garter that hangs around his neck, the garter on his leg, and the little dog here, which I think might well have been painted by a studio assistant, because it does look rather awkward standing there. But he was a very important part of the Earl's story, because apparently he loved his master so much that when he died, he refused to move from under his hearse, so he pined away and died himself. So when the first Earl died in 1570, he was succeeded by his eldest son, Henry, who married Mary Sidney, and this couple are most well-renowned for their patronage of the literary arts. So when he died in 1600, their two sons, William and Philip, who were referred to by Shakespeare as the incomparable brethren, they were to become the third and fourth Earls of Pembroke. And I really see these two brothers, the third and fourth Earls, who were just 4 years apart, as being a kind of double act when it comes to the collecting here. They were both right at the centre of a very small network of people who were collecting passionately in the first half of the 17th century. And it was really one of the most exciting periods of art collecting, because it's really when art came to Britain. And they became part of that tight-knit circle called the Whitehall Circle of courtiers surrounding Charles I, and they all had their houses, their London houses, along the banks of the Thames here at Whitehall. And Durham House, which was the Pembroke's London house, was one of these. So this is a remarkable painting. It's now in the Government Art Collection, but it shows King Charles I and Queen Henrietta Maria with the two brothers, because they're very recognisable, although I can't actually see them from this angle. The third Earl is really quite recognisable standing there, the fourth Earl slightly hiding away in the fireplace there. But what's interesting, it's thought to be the interior of Durham House in the late 1620s, Durham House being the Earl of Pembroke's London house. And so, very little detail, but great prominence given to two paintings on the wall, albeit hung rather oddly high. But that really marks out the Pembrokes, I think, as early collectors in this picture. So this is a painting that's at Wilton, and it's a 17th century one by the artist Franz Franken, and it absolutely captures for me this idea of the frenzy of art collecting that was going on at the moment. See this group here, and they've obviously just received a shipment of paintings, and they're unpacking it all and divvying it all up. And it's rather wonderful, because there are great records in the Royal Collection of swaps that were carried out. So they obviously used to decide amongst themselves who would have what. And this particular painting was at the time obviously in the collection of the Pembrokes, because there's a record in the Royal Collection that the Earl of Pembroke gave this to King Charles I in exchange for a book of Holbein drawings. Well, the Holbein drawings have actually made their way back into the Royal Collection, with the exception of this one, which I know if you do go around the house, it's not always on show, but I know it will be tomorrow. And this is just an example of how beautiful Holbein's drawings were. They were preparatory sketches for painted portraits, but you can see how this is coloured chalks, black chalk, on pink primed paper, which gives those wonderful fleshy tones, and the pen outline there too. It's not actually Lord Cromwell, it says it is, but it's actually the third Baron Abergavenny, who was a neighbour of the first Earl of Pembroke, which is presumably why it's still there. So anyway, it was at this point, the 1630s, that Van Dyck arrived in Britain. And this was a huge moment for art collecting, as any of you who came to the talk last year will remember, because Van Dyck was really responsible for translating the Italian Renaissance into English painting. He had studied a lot, he'd travelled a lot on the continent, and for the first time, the collectors of Raphael and Holbein could actually have their own painter here doing the things that they so admired. And there's one man who's gone down in history as the great Van Dyck patron, and of course it's this man, the fourth Earl of Pembroke. Here he is in his portrait by Van Dyck. And here is his great masterpiece, Van Dyck's great masterpiece. Now, I did talk about this at some length last year, but I have to talk about it again because it's such an extraordinary piece. It's the largest known work by Van Dyck. It's 11 foot tall by 17 foot wide. And it's just a huge moment in British painting because Van Dyck, as I say, was translating the Italian Renaissance. If you just remember that 16th century portrait of the first Earl of Pembroke, you'll see how revolutionary Van Dyck was in his style, because he's actually made his figures really three-dimensional. They're moving on the canvas in a way that the other figure didn't. And of course, Van Dyck, when he started this in 1635, had just returned from travels in Italy, where he would have seen a lot of Titian's painting. He was particularly an ardent fan of Titian, and he would have seen this particular painting, which is Titian's Vendramin portrait. It's now in the National Gallery. And this is often referred to as the greatest group portrait in history, because it not only presents the family in their great importance, but it also covers that great Renaissance theme of the three ages of man, youth on either side, balanced by age and wisdom in the middle. Now, the particularly interesting thing I think about this painting is that in 1636, just when he was painting the great family portrait, a Pembroke family portrait, Van Dyck actually bought this painting by Titian. So it was actually in his collection. And of course, you can see, if you look at it, some compositional similarities. So he's used steps and a pedestal to give height and balance. He's used figure groups with three figures in each, which you can also see in the Pembroke family paintings, the groups of three here, three cherubs, three young boys, three, you know, the new generation, the future generation there, and the steps. And he's also emulated that human gesture. Look at the importance of the hands. And again with Van Dyck's painting. So this is really the first appearance of real Renaissance painting in England, in a way. But what's particularly similar as well is the ambition of the painting, because it's not only a family portrait, it's an ambitious historical narrative painting. Because Van Dyck had been away, he'd re-emerged into England, and he must have been ultra aware of the fact that English society was beginning to crumble just before the outbreak of the Civil War. And so he's recorded this moment in history where the new order and the old order, the royalists and the parliamentarians, are almost balanced precariously, just in the way that the paintings balance between the inside and the outside. And there's the poor Earl in the centre, looking rather helpless as he sees the world he knows crumbling around him. This was just 7 years before the outbreak of civil war. But the patronage of the Earl didn't stop there. And that, as Peter mentioned in his introduction, is what is so extraordinary. This kind of thing, just think back to the painting that we saw of the 1630s interior. What a huge difference this is. This was a great conception of the room as a work of art in itself. In the same vein as 16th and 17th century French and Italian palaces. So the first room in this suite of rooms known as the state apartment is the single cube room, so called because it is a cube in its dimensions. And the ceiling painting in this room is very striking, and it was apparently bought to order for the fourth Earl from a villa in Florence because he particularly wanted this subject, Daedalus and Icarus, to warn future generations of the dangers of flying too close to the sun. He'd obviously been aware of the excesses and then the downfall of the monarchy. The artist, Giuseppe Cesari, was the man who painted this, and at the time in 17th century Rome, he was very successful, not so well known today. In fact, his main claim to fame is that one of his pupils was Caravaggio. And here we are in the double cube room, which is often described as one of the most distinguished rooms in any English country house. And if you haven't been into it, you should go, because it really is. But again, as I say, it's this conception of the room as a work of art. It's one of the earliest examples in any English country house. And there's the earlier interior, just so you can see how bold and forward-looking the Earl was to commission all that. And the crowning glory was the ceiling. Now, instead of commissioning a great, well-known painter to paint his ceiling, he actually chose the son of the royal sergeant painter, K. King Sergeant Painter, and his primary role was really repairing and decorating ships and carriages. So in a way, he was like the painter decorator. And this man, Emmanuel de Cretz, has made an extraordinarily good job of that ceiling, I think. When you consider that a lot of the ceilings we see in great country houses were painted a good 50 years later, the turn of the century, by Italian or French artists, Verrio or Laguerre. And here he's adopted all those visual tricks that you see that we associate with the Baroque. There, that sort of the idea of the dome leading us right out into the sky there, that's typically Baroque mannerist decoration. And that's carried through into the coving, which was by somebody called Edward Pierce, who did a lot of scene painting for Inigo Jones in his masks. And this is another of the Van Dyck paintings that hangs in the double-cued room. And you might recognise it, the three eldest children of Charles I. One of the other things that Van Dyck is credited with is introducing this generic form of romantic costume, which is sort of rather loosely based on 17th century costume rather than accurate record. And that went on being used in English portraiture right up until the 18th century, in particular by Gainsborough, and this is his famous Blue Boy. And you can see just that same lace cuff, lace neck, and the rather elegant shoes there. And so here he was. This astonishing legacy of everything that he had commissioned, he left to his third son, who became the fifth Earl of Pembroke, in 1649. And here he is, also in a portrait by Van Dyck. Now, at the age he was in this portrait, in about 1635, he had gone on a grand tour with his brother. And it was very pioneering still in the first half of the 17th century. The grand tour really only took off in a big way at the end of the 17th century, the beginning of the 18th century. So for two young boys to be sent off at this kind of age was really quite extraordinary. And he must have seen lots of European picture collections like this one. He was certainly very interested in the collection he'd inherited. We don't actually know whether he made many additions to it, but he certainly employed a curator, a Mr. Towers, because records show that Mr. Towers was paid £20 a year to look after all the paintings, and the collection at that point included Titian's, a Correggio, Del Sarto's, Jacopo Palma, a Tintoretto, and a mighty piece by Van Dyck. So the staterooms at Wilton were presumably conceived to entertain Charles I, but of course he came to rather an abrupt end. So in fact, the first person, very fittingly, to be entertained in the rooms was this man, the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Cosimo III of Medici. And he came to stay with the Earl of Wilton, the Earl of Pembroke, the fifth Earl of Pembroke, in 1669. And he stayed about 3 or 4 weeks and is said to have made a gift of about eight paintings, amongst which were two beautiful little Renaissance paintings here. This Andrea del Sarto, mother and child. Andrea del Sarto was a Florentine painter, and his father was a tailor, hence the name Sarto. And this beautiful one by Francesco Mazzuola, better known as Parmigianino, because he came from Parma, and I'm presuming was also quite little. And this is a lovely Virgin and Child with saints, which is a very typical subject for Parmigianino. And here, this is a very striking, I'm afraid that the illustration is not a terribly good one, much better in the flesh, but you can see already this sort of mannerist tradition, the elongated figures, the very elegant fingers, the porcelain-like face of the Madonna there, and the rather theatrical colouring rather than naturalistic. It's a really beautiful little painting by Parmigianino. Like his father, Philip the Fifth Earl was on the side of the parliamentarians during the interregnum. And he was part of a small group of peers known as the Noble Defectors, including Northumberland, Leicester, Somerset and Pembroke. And the Noble Defectors actually played quite an important role in the custodianship of art during that period, because they obviously had the wherewithal to buy up the paintings. They also became great patrons of artists, in particular one portrait artist. And I just want to make the point that patrons were so important to the success of an artist, because I'm just going to show you this portrait here, which I think has appeared on screen, by William Dobson, an English-born painter of the same period, whose patrons were the royalist court. Can you see it?
No,
we can't. Oh, right. No, I must say I can't from here either. Right. I can see it on my screen. Sorry, because without the paintings, it's... Is it? Oh, well, I'm glad you said that. Because I certainly can't see it from here, but I thought it was the angle. Oh, I see the side ones. Okay, well, here's William Dobson's self-portrait anyway. And I'm putting up alongside it, and it is quite important to be able to see these, because I'm putting up alongside it the Peter Lely self-portrait, done at around the same time, and they're so similar. But the point was that Lely had as his patrons the noble defectors, so of course he survived the interregnum and was very well placed to become the court painter to Charles II, which he did. And here is Lely's portrait of Charles II. So Lely was very important, actually, to the collection at Wilton too, in an interesting way, because he was a great collector himself, though an artist, he was a great collector of prints and drawings, old master prints and drawings, presumably so that he could study the techniques of the old masters. But of course, he really provided a bridge between a great collector of the first half of the 17th century, the Earl of Arundel, and the second half, the 8th Earl of Pembroke, including a group, because he bought a group of Raphael drawings from the Earl of Arundel, including this one, which is also at Wilton today. And so the 5th Earl of Pembroke died in 1669, and he was succeeded by his three sons in turn. William as 6th Earl for just 5 years, Philip as the 7th Earl for just 9 years, and that's probably just as well, because he was clearly a very extravagant character and spent most of the fortunes of the estate and married along the way this beautiful woman, Henriette de Kerouaille, who was sister of the more famous Louise, mistress of Charles II. And here she is in a portrait by Lely. And just before we launch into the great collecting period of the 8th Earl of Pembroke, it's worth just comparing again these two portraits, both of which hang at Wilton. On the left is the Van Dyck portrait of Mary Villars, and on the right is the Lely portrait of Henriette de Kerouaille. And you can see how it immediately makes the difference between the two courts, the court of Charles I before the interregnum and the court of Charles II, because in the restoration, the dress code was taken not from the queen, but from the king's mistresses. So you can immediately see, although the dress is quite similar, it's worn in a very different way, off the shoulders, a bare neck. There's no prim row of pearls like in the left. And she's sort of lounging back in an alluring way with much rounder cheeks and fuller lips. So anyway, that's just quite an interesting difference. And this is the 8th Earl of Pembroke, Thomas, the 8th Earl of Pembroke, third son of the 5th Earl, whose period at Wilton really was the best collecting period after the Van Dyck patronage. He was from 1683 to 1733, so a great long period of 50 years, and he really added to the collection in his time. This is a portrait of him by Willem Wissing when he was on Dutch diplomatic missions in 1685. Now, one of the highlights that he bought was actually from Arundel's collection again, and here it is. It was thought at the time, quite understandably, to have been by Leonardo da Vinci, but in fact, there was a copy. Leonardo was known to have painted this subject of Leda and the Swan in 1508, and it was last recorded in the French Royal Collection in 1625. So this is now acknowledged to be a very meticulous copy by Leonardo's pupil, Cesare da Sesto. And it's worth just mentioning that actually copies in those days were much more highly prized than they are today. And in fact, a collector might well have preferred to have a copy of a major painting by a great artist than a lesser work by the artist himself. It was just a sort of status thing, and actually people would have recognized this image. It's a pretty good copy. If we just look quickly at Leonardo's head of Leda drawing in the Royal Collection, we can see just how close he's made that. And of course, he's also captured that characteristic of Leonardo, the sfumato background there with the smoky, hazy look of the landscape, which was so typically Renaissance. The naturalistic background is again a feature of this particular painting by Lorenzo Lotto, the Venetian painter. But again, it's quite interesting to compare the two because he was, as I say, a Venetian painter, and this is very much a Venetian use of colour rather than meticulous detail of Leonardo. Here it's sketchy, tonal. It's all about sort of sketchy colour, really. And this was another painting that he bought at the time. And this is a 17th century Italian painter, Pier Francesco Mola, who was working in Rome in the mid-17th century. And in fact, he was working in the same studio as Caravaggio with Giuseppe Cesari of the Daedalus and Icarus fame in the single cube room. What's quite interesting about this painting is that if we look here, the figure group is exactly the same as this Titian Three Ages of Man. And that just makes a point, really, about what an advantage Italian painters had over anybody trying to become a painter in England, because, of course, they had access to all these great collections. So Mola would have seen, probably, Titian's painting because it was in a private collection that was housed in the Palazzo Riario in Rome at the time. And this beautiful little panel painting, which is also at Wilton, is by Gianfrancesco Penny, The Holy Family with the Lamb. You can probably almost tell that Penny was apprenticed to Raphael. This is such a beautiful copy of a Raphael composition. He was his primary pupil, assistant and copyist, and the original here is in the Prado. So he's really done a very good job, I think. So it was Italian pictures that most people were collecting at this time, but what really marked the 8th Earl of Pembroke out as being different and very adventurous in his taste was that he also collected Dutch and German paintings. This painting is also recorded as having come from that great collector, the Earl of Arundel, and it was thought at the time to be by Dürer because there was a monogram, AD, on the tomb that you can perhaps see in the middle of the centre there. But unfortunately, when it was cleaned later on, the AD washed off rather easily, so it was revealed that, in fact, it probably wasn't by Dürer. But nonetheless, what I love about this, it's a great example. It's called now German School, circa 1500, and it's a great example of that northern Renaissance narrative painting. It's got that very humanist tradition, whereas if we look back quickly, I hope, to the Raphael there, you can see the halos. Both these figures have got halos. This was much more about the human narrative. You can see all those people in the background going about their everyday tasks, and that's really what was so important in these, as I say, Northern Renaissance paintings. And here we are with one of the prize paintings in the collection, Rembrandt. Now, that was another very adventurous choice for the 8th Earl of Pembroke, because although today we might think of Rembrandt as one of the great masters, which indeed he is, it's worth remembering the kind of thing that most people were buying at the time, because this is not mythological, it's not religious, it's not even a grand portrait. It's a very intimate portrait. And it's really almost a study of old age. So it is, in fact, a portrait of Rembrandt's mother. But as I say, it's part portrait and it's part this new genre called atrony, which was a generic study of a head used by artists, really, to study expressions. And Rembrandt was simply not in favour and appreciated in England at the time. Now, the next group of four paintings I've chosen to show because they were bought as a group, and I think in a way that makes the point about the 8th Earl of Pembroke's collecting style, because apart from the fact they were bought as a group, possibly from the Medici collection, there's not very much that links them. So this is the first one. It's by the Spanish 17th century painter Giuseppe de Ribera, and it's Democritus, who was called the laughing philosopher because he had the great philosophy that laughter was the key to life. And this second one here is totally different. It's by the 16th century Dutch painter Lucas van Leyden. And this is a really interesting painting, actually, because it foreshadows a whole great movement of genre painting, which was to become the great genre in Dutch 17th century art, but this is really early 16th century. It was probably painted in 1514 when the painter was just 20. And like Dürer, he's a great printmaker, actually. You can see that clarity of line that would translate so well onto a copper plate. And this, possibly, one of the most famous in the collection, Tintoretto, Christ washing the feet of the disciples. Again, totally different. Tintoretto was one of three great Venetian Renaissance painters, Titian, Veronese, and Tintoretto. And you can see immediately, he normally paints on a very large scale, as anyone who's been to the Scuola Grande in Rome, in Venice, will know. But here, this sense of drama and movement that if you are going around the house tomorrow, you'll be able to see, because it doesn't really capture it here. It's that very mannerist sense of theatricality and the detail, again, of the hands, the elongated fingers, and Tintoretto's typical palette, where he uses all these bold, clashing reds that actually shouldn't work together at all, but they somehow do. And then the fourth picture in this group, again, totally different. This is by Rubens. It's a little group called Four Putti at the time, but now identified as Christ, St. John, and two angels. And it's really rather charming, but what's rather amusing, I think, about this painting is that it's a collaboration between Rubens and his fellow Flemish painter, Frans Schneiders, who was known for his still lives. And you can see there's this rather incongruous group of fruit and flowers in the front. It's almost as if we got two paintings for the price of one. But it's rather lovely the way these artists all collaborated together. Bruegel was another very adventurous choice for the 8th Earl. Again, no one else was collecting Bruegel at this time, but interestingly, Holland had made a gift of paintings to Charles II on his return to the English throne, which was known as the Dutch Gift, which contained the famous Massacre of the Innocents by Peter Bruegel the Elder, which is still in the royal collection. So the more discerning of the restoration collectors, of which we can definitely say Thomas the 8th Earl of Pembroke was one, would have seen work by Bruegel. So this one here is actually by Peter Bruegel the Younger. The Bruegels are extremely confusing family of painters, but Peter Bruegel the Younger actually was best known for making good copies of his father's popular compositions, and this is a case in point. It's called The Bird Trap. You can see The Bird Trap in the right there. Whereas this, by Jan Bruegel, who's Peter Bruegel the Younger's brother, Jan Bruegel tended to paint his own compositions, and he was actually nicknamed Jan Velvet Bruegel because he was so wonderful at capturing texture. And it's quite interesting, if you look at it, actually the snow in this painting, I think, seems much softer than the snow in his brother's painting, I'd be tempted to say. It's probable that these were bought in Holland when the Earl was travelling in 1685 at the time of the Vissing portrait. So we've just seen a quick flash through the whole spectrum of the things that he was collecting. And just to bring it back to what was more often being collected at this time, here we are with a contemporary, late 17th century Italian painter, Luca Giordano. And this, in the context of Wilton, is rather a nice story because it's a very good example of teamwork between two successive earls. It was bought by the 8th Earl and hung over the Great Staircase. And then it was moved later by the 9th Earl, who put it in the ceiling, in the corner room, where it still is at Wilton, because he obviously thought it would be rather more dramatic, which I think it probably is. Anyway, so that's rather a nice little sort of one earl building on the collection of the other. In 1731, shortly before he died, the 8th Earl commissioned this catalogue of the description of the Earl of Pembroke's pictures by Count Gamberini of Lucca. And it may not seem a very big thing now, but it was extraordinary in the time because there were no catalogues of country house collections at all. And in a way, it was the Earl recognising that it was quite spectacular to have such a collection. It was very important to record a collection so that it could be kept together and traced. So that was a very big moment, and of course many, many other collections followed on. And just quickly, before we leave the 8th Earl, I just wanted to show you this, which was pointed out to me as I went round the house. This view of Wilton. It was commissioned by the 8th Earl in around 1700 from the Dutch artist Leonard Kneff. And it was very typical of the Dutch genre known as landscape, which was a forerunner for the English landscape, but obviously there's quite a long way to go, as you can see. But one of the most amusing things, I think, is how the artist has flattered his patron, because look at the grand Wilton there in the centre, and then if you look down, you probably won't be able to see on the screen, but look on the side screens, you can just make out the minuscule spire of Salisbury Cathedral. So he really was flattering his patron in a big way. So this portrait of Henry, Lord Herbert, son of the 8th Earl, by Jonathan Richardson, was commissioned by his father in around 1710, when he was just about 16, and this is when he went on his grand tour. And one of the things you have to remember about this man, who is about to become the 9th Earl, is that he grew up in one of the most spectacular Inigo Jones interiors in England. So it's no wonder that he became passionate about architecture, which he did. The other thing that I think must have had quite a bearing is that his father didn't die until he was 40. So he had plenty of time to become a real eccentric, which I think he really was. One of his friends at Oxford was William Stukeley, the antiquarian and archaeologist, and apparently the two used to disappear for days on end to Stonehenge, measuring stones and so on. And another friend from his Oxford days was this man, Andrew Fountain of Narford Hall in Norfolk, who was a very important art collector and, in fact, advised a lot of his friends on art collecting too, including the Earl of Pembroke. This portrait is during a grand tour in 1714 when they went off together buying sculpture and paintings for their collections, and it's taken in the Uffizi. He became honorary librarian at Wilton and spent so much time there that there was apparently at the time even a room called the Fountain Room. And here he is, but in a sculpted portrait by Roubilliac, and there's a record in the house records called Herbert's House Book for this 9th Earl, a payment of £30 to the sculptor. And look how wonderful he looks, just like a Roman emperor. Another entry in the same Herbert's House Book records payments to a Roger Morris, Clerk of Works, and John de Val Mason between 1735 to 7. Because one of the 9th Earl's really important contributions to Wilton was this beautiful Palladian bridge, based on Palladio's design for the Rialto. And Horace Walpole said of the 9th Earl, his great excellence was architecture, and said that the bridge at Wilton is more beautiful than anything of Lord Burlington or Kent, which was high praise indeed coming from him. He also, this architect Earl, as he became known, designed several other buildings, most of which no longer survive, including one called Westcombe. And there's rather a lovely story about how he tried to rent it to the Duchess of Marlborough, who then wrote to her granddaughter saying, "My Lord Herbert's house at Greenwich is the most ridiculous thing I ever saw in my life. One cannot help thinking soon after one gets into the house that it must have been built by somebody that is quite mad." Because apparently he'd been so conscious of designing it so beautifully and mathematically that he'd ended up with a tiny triangular room with three doors opening inwards so you couldn't get in or out. But artist collaboration is again present here, because apparently these paintings are by George Lambert, and the figures are actually by Hogarth. But these paintings, although they're hung in a very unassuming place at Wilton, are a really important record, because there are no preparatory drawings for the 9th Earl's buildings, and these really are a record of Westcombe House that no longer survives. Back at Wilton, he even brought his architecture and his love of architecture into the house, because he commissioned William Kent to design these beautiful settees, a set of six for the double cube room. And what's rather lovely here is that it's the 9th Earl paying homage to his ancestors, patronage of Inigo Jones, because William Kent and the 9th Earl of Pembroke were passionate about Palladio, as indeed was Inigo Jones. The other thing he did was commission a French painter, Ondien de Clermont, to paint four ceilings, as we again know from Herbert's house book, where he records payments to the little French painter at a rate of about £50 a ceiling. And this is when he must have moved the Giordano from the staircase to the ceiling in the corner room. His career as an architect culminated, as did his life, if we believe the stories, in the building of Westminster Bridge. After his success at Wilton, with the bridge. He went on to become very involved in the building of Westminster Bridge. He laid the first stone in 1739 and the last stone in 1750, but sadly died shortly afterwards due to a great argument about the bridge. So anyway, he was obviously a man with a passionate temper. But despite this, he was a loyal and loving husband who adored his wife and animals, apparently, and made some very practical contributions to the collection at Wilton, as we've seen. He handed the baton to his son, also called Henry, who became the 10th Earl of Pembroke in 1750. And here he is in one of those spectacular grand portraits by the Italian artist Pompeo Battoni. What one has to admire about this man is he was collecting in the second half of the 18th century, which was a huge period for collecting in England. But what you have to admire about him is, again, like his other fellow Earls of Pembroke, he ploughed his own furrow. He didn't do what everyone else was doing. So, for example, when everyone else was buying up Canaletto and Claude, he was the patron of this man, Richard Wilson, who is perhaps undersung for his importance in the advent of landscape painting to Britain. Richard Wilson was a Welsh painter, and he went to Rome in the 1750s, and his aim really was to become the new Claude, to bring Claudian landscape back to Britain, which I believe he did. His Italian sketchbook of 1754 records an excursion to the ruins near Tivoli, where he dined and spent the day together on the spot under a large tree with four English lords, one of whom was the 10th Earl of Pembroke. And on their return to England, Pembroke immediately commissioned him to paint six views of Wilton, which he did. And here you can see the Claudian elements. I don't know how clear it comes out, but this idea of using the thing like the lone tree, and even Wilton looks rather like a sort of distant palazzo, and the way that the leaves are highlighted against the sky, all these are really clear items, things that were set out by Claude. And this is really early when you think of it. This was in the 1750s. And, you know, if you think of Constable's painting, he wasn't really till the beginning of the 19th century. The Heywain is something like 1820 or something like that. So, you know, this is really ahead of his time. And here's another view of Wilton from the southeast. He became, Richard Wilson, one of the founder members of the Royal Academy of Arts, but I think he then became an alcoholic, so he sort of died in poverty. And I think for that reason, is not perhaps as well known as he should be for the contribution he made. But anyway, there's a great series of six paintings at Wilton, and here we are. And so for me, that series of paintings at Wilton is a really important step for British landscape painting, and it's also a very important moment for the 10th Earl of Pembroke as a patron. One of his great passions was horses. He ran a riding school at Wilton, and he wrote a manual on cavalry movements for the British Army. So he made another charming, if rather eccentric, contribution to art history by commissioning the master of the horse to the Austrian court and the founder of the Spanish riding school, who was called Baron Rice d'Eisenberg, to produce a series of 55 gouache paintings. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, they're the only set known to exist. But they do exist still, hung together in their mid-18th century frames in really astonishingly good condition. So again, whether you like horses or whether you like his style of painting, it's really worth going to see these things because they are just one of a kind. And they are absolutely something that was commissioned and made possible by the 10th Earl of Pembroke. Here he is in later life, painted by Sir Joshua Reynolds. And here is his wife with their son, George, who was to become the 11th Earl of Pembroke. And so there we are, the 11th Earl of Pembroke. Now, he was a very responsible man by all accounts. And although he didn't make huge contributions to the collection, he really looked after it. He brought a lot of wealth into the estate and he really secured it. And made huge contributions to the upkeep of both house and collection. And he married first the beautiful Elizabeth Beauclerc, here in a portrait by Beechey, and secondly, Catherine Vorontsov, and here she is by Thomas Lawrence, who continued her husband's good work. And it does seem a little bit unfair that I've run out of time to do justice to the later generations. But the best testament, I think, to them all is the fact that behind this beautiful, restrained Palladian facade at Wilton lies this astonishing collection. And I've only been able to give you a brief overview of some of the items. There are many more to be discovered tomorrow. And they've all done their bits. For example, the 16th Earl, the current Earl's grandfather, wrote a great picture, a great catalogue of the Pritchett collection, which is very interesting. His father spent a lot of time conserving the staterooms and the Palladian South Front, and he himself has reconstructed the sculpture gallery and has been very involved in trying to retrace and put back together parts of the collection that have been lost along the way. So if you do go round together tomorrow, you should definitely ask your guides for some of the great stories about where they found bits of ancient sarcophagi, because they're quite intriguing. Anyway, to finish, as I was looking back at the talk I gave here last year, I noticed something rather interesting in my final slide. If you look behind the bust, again, I don't know how well you can see it, but if you look behind the bust there, the painting hanging on the wall is none other than the Wilton Parmigianino, which I'll show you there. And I think that's where it says it all, really, that the collectors, the Pembroke Earls, collectors have long played a part in this country's collection and have made a very important contribution. So I do hope that I will have whetted your appetite to go and look at some more tomorrow. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.